Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. On November 22, 1963, 40 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. We mark that event in history with an interview with Robert Dallek, the author of a new book on the slain leader titled An Unfinished Life. And after that, Joyce Appleby will join us to give us her thoughts on the nation's commitment to eradicate poverty. But first, Joyce Gidmore takes a look at another important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on November 21, 1877, Thomas Edison announced the invention of the phonograph, an invention that earned him the title the Wizard of Menlo Park. His pioneering recording, done with a stylus on a tinfoil cylinder, was of Mary Had a Little Lamb. The phonograph was first used as a dictation machine, but later its use as an entertainment tool came to the fore. In 1906, Edison formed the National Phonograph Company and launched a series of musical recordings. Famous in his own lifetime, Edison was responsible for over 1,000 patents, including one for the light bulb. People called him a genius, but Edison replied, "Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." On October 21, 1931, a few days after his death, electric lights were dimmed across the nation for 1 minute.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a new study reports that Nazi Germany used hundreds of hospitals and clinics to kill at least 200,000 handicapped, mentally ill, and other institutional patients who were deemed inferior. The study is based on what researchers say was the most comprehensive analysis of Nazi records on the sites that helped carry out Adolf Hitler's program to purify, as he saw it, the German race. The report, compiled by Germany's Federal Archive, provides new evidence on the program under which doctors and hospital staff used gas, drugs, and starvation to kill disabled men, women, and children at medical facilities in Germany and in present-day Austria, Poland, and the Czech Republic. The deaths were officially classified as mercy killings. And remains of ceramics, figurines, and other seemingly innocuous artifacts found throughout Central America have been identified as evidence for violent destruction rituals enacted against buildings and their inhabitants, according to a new book, The Archaeology of Settlement Abandonment in Middle America, edited by Takeshi Inomata. The book provides evidence supporting the theory of the fierce destruction of buildings by the Maya and other early Central American civilizations as part of a termination ritual that grew out of a belief that the act of destruction represented the spiritual defeat of the enemy. The Maya appear to have thought buildings and certain objects were animated and charged with supernatural powers, which required the releasing of their enemy's spirits following their defeat in battle. This is Talking History.
President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas were both hit by a would-be assassin's bullets as they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile a short while ago. That is the latest word that has just come in from Dallas on United Press International. The Associated Press, in its first report, says that President Kennedy was shot just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy, who was riding with him, jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy and cried, "Oh, no." The motorcade sped on. Riding in the same car with the president for this particular motorcade was Governor and Mrs. John B. Connally, the governor of the state of Texas. According to the last report, both the president and the governor were hit by the bullets. And now one more ad has come in. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, is dead at the age of 46. Shot by an assassin as he drove through the streets of Dallas, Texas, less than an hour ago.
An Unfinished Life has been hailed as the first authoritative single-volume life of John F. Kennedy to be written in nearly four decades. Drawing upon first-hand sources, freshly unearthed documents, and never-before-opened archives, prize-winning historian Robert Dallek reveals more than we ever knew about John Kennedy, forever changing the way we think about his life, his presidency, and his legacy. And the author, Robert Dallek, professor of history at Boston University, is our guest this week from Washington, marking the 40th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It's good to have you, and your book certainly is getting high praise, and it's well-deserved.
Thank you.
But there have been a number of books on John Kennedy. In fact, you even acknowledged that in your preface, where you more or less posed the question, why another Kennedy book? So let me throw it back at you.
Sure.
Why another Kennedy book?
Well, because there's always new material opening, and when I began this a little over 5 years ago now, I had the feeling, the impression that there would be new materials coming to hand, national security files, all histories that had not been read before. Now, I knew there was the medical records, which had never been seen by a biographer. I didn't know I was going to get into these, but I certainly intended to ask, and my request was rewarded with a positive answer, though it took roughly 2.5 years before that happened. But, you know, 30 to 40 years after a presidential administration, generally the records are more available, the family supporters of that president are more relaxed about letting you into these records. And so I was confident that there would be some pretty fresh, interesting material, and I was not disappointed.
Well, I want to get to certainly the points that you add to the story, and we'll talk a little bit about what difference it makes to have a 30-year perspective. But let me ask you a question I suppose we have to start with, which is, why is JFK so popular? I mean, I grew up in Massachusetts, and my family and extended family had Kennedy plates and pictures on the wall and everything else. And yet, you know, from an historian's perspective, one could, I'm not so sure convincingly, one could at least make a case that he really didn't get a lot done during his presidency in terms of the passage of legislation. So why is he so popular?
Yeah, I think your point is an excellent one. You look at his domestic record, not a single one of his major initiatives was passed during his presidency. Civil rights, the tax cut, the federal aid to education, Medicare, a war on poverty that he talked about, a Department of Transportation, a Department of Urban Development. None of these came to fruition. They were all part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society achievements. But they were initiated by Kennedy. Still, what was the record? Also, there's the fact that he was president for only 1,000 days. It was the sixth shortest presidency in the country's history, the third shortest in the 20th century. But when you ask people, who is the greatest president in American history, consistently over the last 40 years, Kennedy comes in the top three or four. So I think what explains it is, first of all, he was assassinated. But that's not enough to account for this. William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, and he was a popular president who had been elected to his second term. 40 years later, hardly anybody remembered who he was. I think it has a lot to do with television. Kennedy's memory is kept alive in our minds. He's frozen in our minds at the age of 46. We can't believe that this past May 29th, he would have been 86 years of age. And he's there on tape, so charismatic, so handsome, attractive, witty, charming, engaging, and he continues to be a very compelling figure. But beyond that, I think what's most important, maybe, in explaining his continuing hold on the public, not only here, but around the world, because in Germany, in Italy, in Britain, in Asia, in Latin America, he's something of an iconic figure. I think he gave people a sense of hope, and he spoke to America's bitter angels and invoked American principles, high-minded ideals. He spoke of a new frontier. He promised to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. There was an alliance for progress. There was a Peace Corps. His rhetoric was inspiring, and I think this continues to play a significant part in the attractiveness that he holds for so many people. And also I think it speaks to the fact that there's been so much cynicism about American politics and about the leaders we've had over the last 40 years. And Kennedy, what comes after is, of course, Vietnam and Johnson's credibility gap and the Watergate crisis and Nixon deceiving the country and the Church Committee hearings in 1975 showing all the government skullduggery, Watergate, Ronald Reagan, and the Iran-Contra affair. There's been so much cynicism about the American politics, and Kennedy remains a kind of idealized figure. One last point about this. Ted Sorensen, his White House counsel and speechwriter, said that after Kennedy died, people said to him that they felt the loss of Kennedy's life more than they felt the death of their own parents. And Sorensen thought this was because when their parents died, they lost a part of the past, but when Kennedy died, they lost a part of the future. And I think there's probably a considerable accuracy or persuasion to that. And people say that they think Kennedy's memory will fade over the next 40 years or 50 years, and I don't think so. I think he's kind of gained a place in the pantheon of American presidents the way Washington and Lincoln and FDR have. Washington starts the country on its way. Lincoln saves it. FDR overcomes the Depression, so to speak, and leads us through World War II. And Kennedy is a kind of hopeful figure. And hope caught cut short, but the public still keeps it alive.
Well, all good points, and I suspect you're right, but how does he escape at least some cynicism? You yourself have added yet another affair, this Mimi, the White House intern, sort of shades of Bill Clinton. Yeah. How does he get away with this?
Yeah, it's a very good point, because not just the womanizing, but the medical also, because what I laid out in my book was the extent to which there was a cover-up of his various ailments and how much they hid from the public about his physical condition. I think the public, the country needs myths. They need a mythological, iconic figure. And Kennedy provides that. And so they look on the positive side, for example, with the medical. What they see is not a man who was so ill, but now what they see is a man who was so courageous that he joins the Navy. He didn't have to be in the service during World War II, but he not only goes into the Navy, but he lobbies to get into combat and then becomes a hero by rescuing his crew after his PT-109 is cut in half by a Japanese destroyer. So the public looks on the positive side. They want to see him as heroic. And the same, I think, with the womanizing. It's like with Bill Clinton. The public didn't want to impeach Clinton. They didn't want to throw him out of office. He was impeached, of course, but they didn't want to see him kicked out of office. And I think it's because they saw Clinton's transgressions as private rather than public. And the same with Kennedy. His private transgressions, in a sense, people feel, well, that's between, or was between him and his wife, as it has been between Bill Clinton and Hillary. And what's the public record? What did he achieve? And people also, I think, take hope from the thought that if he had lived, he would have certainly had a second term. He would have run probably against Barry Goldwater, would have won the landslide, would have had big majorities in the House and the Senate the way Lyndon Johnson did. And then, I think, defying the tradition that a second term is usually a downer, I think Kennedy would have had a very good second term. I think he would have passed all his major initiatives. And I don't think he ever would have gotten us into Vietnam to the extent that Lyndon Johnson did, because Kennedy was very skeptical of the military, and there's really pretty compelling evidence of his doubts about Americanizing that war.
Well, I may come back to that one, but let me ask you just for one more moment on the medical and the affairs in the White House. As an historian now, popular opinion aside, do you feel that either threatened or posed a threat to his performance as president?
Yeah, well, sure. It certainly posed a threat to his performance as president. I, in fact, looked closely at the medical records and something called an MAR, Medicine Administration record, and set it down alongside of the Cuban Missile Crisis and other crises he's passed through in order to answer the question, did his medical ailments, did his various physical problems have an impact on his conduct of the office? And what I found was that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, he was as lucid, as cogent as you would ever want a president to be. And so, generally, my answer is no. I don't see that he was really in any way deterred from performing quite effectively despite these medical problems. Now, when he went to his private quarters at night, the guy may have been zonked or somewhat out of it. But when he was dealing with big issues, crises, he was just in top-notch shape. Now, as far as the womanizing goes, he also, I think, he was a risk-taker. I think there were risks here. But he operated in a very different culture from the one Bill Clinton operated in, from our contemporary mores, are so different. In the 1960s, some journalists knew or suspected strongly the womanizing. And I asked some of them I spoke to, why did you go after this? Why wasn't it exposed? And they said it simply was at odds with the contemporary assumptions about what a journalist printed, what a TV reporter reported. In other words, you didn't invade a president's sex life or his private life that way. It's true, if a president or a public figure was crossing the line with bribes or influence peddling or money was inappropriately changing hands, they would have gone after that. There was a tradition of doing that. But revealing a president's sexual transgressions, that simply wasn't something that they did. And also, as somebody said to me back from that era, who operated in that era in the 60s, that the journalists were doing it too. Senators were carrying on that way. So if anybody stepped forward and said, oh, my goodness, look what the president is doing, it would have been an act of consummate hypocrisy. So I think that while there was risk-taking, I think it was substantially less than than the risks that Bill Clinton took by his affair with Monica. Kennedy was pretty confident that he was not in terrible jeopardy. As he once said, it's not news until it gets to the front page of the New York Times, and the New York Times was not going to print that kind of story in the 1960s.
Good comment. Two topics loom large in your book, Cuba and Vietnam. Very briefly, how would you assess Kennedy's handling of both of those?
Yeah. Cuba, a mixed record. He, of course, fails at the Bay of Pigs, sanctions the invasion of Cuba by the Cuban exiles. It's a miserable failure. And Kennedy afterwards walks around saying to himself repeatedly, how could I have been so stupid? And he fessed up that he was the one responsible for this and did not try to avert evade the responsibility. Then he, of course, continues on a wrong-headed policy, one might say, toward Cuba. They practice what's called support, what's known as Operation Mongoose, an attempt to possibly assassinate Castro, to overturn his government, to get rid of him. And that gets nowhere either, and in fact, in part, opens the door to the Cuban Missile Crisis, because Khrushchev is able to convince Castro that Kennedy is determined to assassinate him or topple him, and that if Castro will allow Khrushchev to put the Soviet missiles into Cuba, it will give a guarantee of Cuban security. So Khrushchev takes a big gamble. Kennedy has provoked this crisis by these plots to overturn Castro. But then Kennedy operates in a brilliant fashion during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's very skeptical of his military. He doesn't think they've given him good advice in the past, and he doesn't want to either bomb or invade, as they're urging him to do. Instead, he resorts to diplomacy, and it works. And he resolves with Khrushchev's agreement the missile crisis. And we know now from Soviet documents that have become available that we came so very close to a nuclear holocaust, and that the Cuban Missile Crisis was certainly Kennedy's best moment as a president. After that, in the closing months of his presidency, he knew by then that his Cuban policy was at a dead end, and he was open to a rapprochement with Castro. There were back-channel negotiations going on, discussions about a possible rapprochement. It's impossible to say if Kennedy had lived whether such would have taken place. Castro might have insisted on American evacuation of Guantanamo. Kennedy never would have done that. But there certainly is a possibility that we would have gotten onto a better plane with them. As for Vietnam, Kennedy, again, a somewhat mixed record. When he enters office, there's about 650 American military advisors there. By the time Kennedy died in November of 1963, there were 16,700 advisors. So he expanded American involvement without question. But the deeper we Connolly got in, the more skeptical, in a sense, Kennedy became. Indeed, what you find is that by 1962, he was directing Robert McNamara to lay plans to remove America's military advisors from there by 1965. He was very skeptical of Americanizing the war. The last conversation he had about Vietnam was the day in November he left for Dallas, Texas, and he said to his Assistant Secretary of State for Far East, Mike Forrestal, "When I come back from Texas, we've got to review this whole Vietnam issue, including the question of when and how we get out of there." So there was a lot of skepticism on his part. There's other evidence to support this proposition, and I think he never would have escalated that war to the extent that Lyndon Johnson did and got us stuck, so to speak, in that quagmire.
Well, I'm sure that's going to continue to be a burning question for people. But
without question.
That's where we're going to have to leave it. And so let me thank you for joining us. And congratulations on the success of your new book.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Robert Dallek, author of An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, published by Little Brown and Company. And this is Talking History.
This Mass has been offered for John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States. May he rest in peace.
For our site of the week, we continue on the subject of John F. Kennedy by calling to your attention a new museum exhibit on the former president. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Jacqueline Kennedy, books under her arm, walks with fellow students to class. John Kennedy, the junior senator from Massachusetts, studies a document in his office, and the newlyweds examine wedding photos in the privacy of their own home. These are among 55 black-and-white photos taken in May 1954 during the couple's first year of marriage and that comprise Camelot at Dawn, a new exhibit at the Smithsonian's Art and Industries Building in Washington, D.C. Photographer Orlando Suero took the photos from an article that appeared in McCall's magazine, intended to portray a typical week in the Kennedys' life. Married on September 12, 1953, the Kennedys were eager to project an idyllic portrait of happy young newlyweds, even as John was positioning himself to run for higher office. It was the start of what was to become the Camelot image of the Kennedy White House. Camelot at Dawn runs through January 4, 2004.
And finally, few of us seriously question the old maxim that the poor will always be with us. Nevertheless, from time to time we do try to lessen their burden, even eradicate poverty altogether. Historian Joyce Appleby reflects on such efforts by making comparisons to another reform movement in history, the movement to end slavery. Appleby, recently retired as professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles, is the author of dozens of articles and books on topics in American history. Her most recent book, titled Thomas Jefferson, was published earlier this year by Henry Holt and Company.
Alabama's Governor Bob Riley has introduced a measure to lift the tax burden from the state's poorest taxpayers. To his many critics, he replied that the New Testament teaches us to help those who are the least among us. Advocates for the poor, such as Riley, are pushing against the same obstacles that 18th century opponents of slavery confronted: acceptance of an evil because of its familiarity. It's hard to be outraged by a condition that's been around for millennia. People once thought slavery ineradicable. Then, with remarkable suddenness, slavery appeared intolerable. In 1780, Pennsylvania abolished it, the first legislature in the world to extinguish a system as old as the Bible. All the northern states followed Pennsylvania's example. On the eve of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln warned that a house divided against itself cannot stand. This government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. But the same Lincoln quoted scripture to say that the poor will always be with us. Breaking through this resignation has not proved easy. The 19th century English radical William Cobbett was the first to denounce the cruelty of jobs that kept workers fully employed but did not pay them enough to feed their families. He excoriated his contemporaries for favoring public handouts to adequate wages. Cobbett's working poor have now attracted the attention of today's living wage advocates, but the level of general concern has not changed much. Most of us merely deplore poverty in dinner table conversations before asking someone to pass the lamb chops. Sympathy for those who work full-time and still find themselves below the poverty line gets deflected into the conviction that little can be done to change the situation. Yet we could join Governor Riley in his campaign to help the least among us. We could reject minimum wage laws in favor of living wage laws that guaranteed all who work a decent living. Social Security taxes, the most onerous payroll deduction for the poor, could be graduated. The income cap of $87,000 doubled. There are other ways to attack the problem, were there but a will to do so. The rise of evangelical Christianity fueled the anti-slavery movement, as did the Enlightenment's ardent embrace of liberty. Personal freedom stood in stark contrast to slavery. Few ever imagined that they could escape actual shackles, but people do believe that if poor, they would use their freedom to lift themselves out of poverty's abyss. Thinking through poverty involves a searching self-examination. It's hard to imagine ourselves handicapped by want and the consequences of inadequate schooling and health care. What will ever prod us to confront poverty as our forebears did slavery? What will awake our slumbering consciences? We've had the quickening of religious fervor recently, but today's evangelicals have yet to evince any sustained concern for America's working poor. If not from them, where will the empathy emerge that says, "There but for the grace of God go I"?
You've been listening to Joyce Appleby, retired professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles. Appleby's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.